Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Sound Health Option Show with Richard Talk To Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry. Uh-oh. Technical error. Alert. Just one moment, please. There we go. Now I'll try that again. Good morning, Sherry. Sorry.
Good morning. Don't you just love all this technology?
It only takes one little tab to, like, make the whole thing come to a stop. It's amazing.
I have this question that I've been waiting to ask our guests about the difference in play now and how technology comes into it. So I'm anxious to get into the show. We should tell people that we are simultaneously broadcasting on Blog Talk Radio, where you can listen to the show, and then on WebEx from our site, soundhealthoptions.com, where you can watch the show. We would appreciate it, though, if you would go over to Blog Talk and check in, because we get credit and move up on their important list, or whatever you call it, of great and featured shows. So if you just go over there and check in, Richard, isn't your opinion that the sound at Blog Talk Radio is better?
I always like the audio quality at Blog Talk Radio. I think it's a little cleaner, a little crisper, just easier to hear. So for people that are on WebEx listening to us, for a little better audio, if you want to listen, you can just call in at 347-850-1407, and you can just listen at that feed. If you have a question, you can press 1, I believe it is. But you can just listen there, which is what I do. I listen at that number, and then I watch the WebEx feed, because I'm over here running Blog Talk Radio, so I'm answering, having conversation and chat and engineering the show. And then Sherry's over there at WebEx running that, showing visuals, showing vocal prints sometimes, and or looking at web pages that the author, that Ann Gadzikowski, will refer to. And you can get to both of those easily by going to soundhealthoptions.com and then click on the radio tab. And for this show, you click on Blog Talk Radio, and it will show both a link to the Blog Talk Radio page and also the link to the WebEx feed as well.
And there's links there to where I was on Joyce Riley's Power Hour, and we're going to be doing more of that, more of the presidential candidates. But we're glad to have you with us. Whether or not you're on Blog Talk Radio or WebEx, we have a special guest today. Richard, would you pronounce her last name for me?
Gadzikowski.
I don't think I would have made that. She's an author and an educator, and although I'm a mother of 3 and a grandmother of 11 and a great-grandmother of 14, my best times with my kids were play times, and I didn't know there was a structure and a big purpose to it. I just was having fun. So I had my kids in the 60s, so games were very different, and so our guest is going to bring us some insightful information about the best way to play with our kids and some of the things what not to do. Excuse me. We're coming to you from the studios of Sound Health and the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology. We're a registered 501c3 nonprofit. We're the largest alternative research center in Ohio. And we give away software. Well, we sell some too, but we give it away. So we're going to be doing a drawing on the people who are joining us in this show, either from Blog Talk or Richard, how do we know who joined us on Blog Talk so we can add them to our drawing?
Well, I think the best way for people at Blog Talk really is to email in for the drawing. And can you tell us what that email address is? I always forget.
Well, let's just have them do it to sherryedwards@gmail.com, so I'll make sure it goes to the right place. And that's Sharry. We do have a radio address, but like Richard, I've forgotten it. There's so many, I just can't keep them straight. That's the real problem. So we're going to be drawing for a nutrition or a pre-vac. And pre-vac is pre-vaccination risk factors. That both of those deal with children, because after they get their vaccination, sometimes there is nutritional issues. And that's one of our announcements about one of the things that just freaks me out, Richard. Hospitals are taking custody of children because they don't think the parents are doing a good job in getting their kids vaccinated. That's just crazy to me. It looks like a parent should be able to make that decision. But I heard some lady on the radio said, we must have a herd mentality. Everything is for the betterment of the herd. And if your children are one that goes down because of vaccination, just kind of suck it up because it's better for the herd. Now, I thought we are better than animals. This really rankles me. There is a wonderful place to get information about vaccines, and it's NVIC, National Vaccine Information Center.org. Don't do .com because it comes up some porno site. So I'll put that in the chat for you. But I think that's absolutely disgusting. Remember that Pellier case that we had on where they took this girl probably over a year and finally the parents got her back because the hospital had misdiagnosed her? Oh, don't get on that soapbox, Sherry. Okay. So we're trying to bring you this show and all of these announcements to provide new information, more supportive information for an authentic life. So if you want nutrition software, if you want to join some of our free classes, go to our site, soundhouseoptions.com. Do you have any announcements, Richard?
I could say that I was surprisingly moved by John Boehner's, less so about the announcement that he's stepping down from Speaker of the House, more so by hearing news reports of his meetup, unintentional meetup with the Pope, and how he's not saying that it had anything to do with him the next day deciding to step down, but just a lot of conversation, both reading and hearing sound snippets, that he seemed to have a very moving experience when he met the Pope. I mean, literally met the Pope one-on-one unintentionally. They were like passing in a hallway and it just happened.
Well, we follow him because he's from Ohio, and he was doing great for Ohio until he had a meeting with Obama. And I think that meeting with Obama, and it's my opinion, was about blackmail or whatever else was going on, because from that time forward, Boehner was on Obama's side, and he was such a different person. Now I think maybe he's finally come to the conclusion that he's going to clean up his act. I would love that to be the truth.
I'd love it if Congress would clean up their act, but that's another show. The least effective Congress in history, period, currently.
Well, that's a show we do on Tuesdays.
Stunning.
We should invite
exactly, excuse me.
To our Tuesday happy hour and Direction for Truth.
Absolutely.
I have two more announcements, and then I want to get to our guests as soon as possible. So I'll just kind of skim over these real quick. Bill and Melinda Gates have pledged $10 billion, with a B, for vaccines. You can go read it. Just put in Bill Gates, $10 billion, and they gave $8 point something billion over here. We wrote to them telling them what we could do with pre-vaccination risk factors, and that it is a fact that some children are hurt by this. And they wrote back the most horrible letter, you know, keep your thoughts to yourself. We don't want to hear from you. We don't hear from people like you. It was very degrading. And when I looked at who it was from, it was somebody that was a former big pharma rep. So forced vaccinations are going on. There is how to get a vaccine exemption legally from Mercola. I will put that information in the chat for people. I think people are going to stand up. The truth is coming out, and we're gonna make them stop treating our children like cattle. There is no herd mentality here. Our children belong to us, not to the hospital, not to the state. Now, I can see where they have to step in. Somebody's beating their kids or shooting them up with heroin, and we had a case like that here in Ohio where a mother was shooting her kids up. I can see that. But there's a line someplace where if there is proof that this could be an issue, if there's proof from the doctor that this family has this issue, you know, you can't get a job now in the medical world without vaccines and forced vaccinations and things that are making people sick. I think we're going to look back on this era, and then I'll shut up. This is like sacrificing virgins for a good crop. That's how stupid and how detrimental this is. And they can fix it by making a test of some kind to see which of these children are going to be hurt. And it's a simple one. It's quercetin. It's kids with blood clotting problems. They could do that. And I don't understand, after having to pay billions of dollars in vaccine damages, why they don't. Okay, I'm going to shut up here. Oh, I do have one other exciting announcement. The keynote is up, and that's on our site. I don't think the one is up for this week, but based on the keynote and all of the music and sounds that were affected and influenced by, and I'm sure our guest is going to talk to us about music and play, Jill Mattson has created a series of music of tones so that you can match your birth note or match the notes or colors you need with the music. And she has a new book. We've been talking to her about it for a year, Lost Waves of Time, and it's out. And you can get a peek, ancient-music.com, and I will put that in the chat for people. She gives a very large portion of that book away for people. So I'm excited about that. I'll put that up as Richard is introducing our guest.
That's very exciting to hear that Jill's book is finally out. We've been talking about it so long, I thought it was out already. And I love, as we know, I love her material. So that's very exciting. And our guest, Anne Gadzikowski, is an author and an educator with a passion for challenging children to think creatively and critically. A graduate of Erickson Institute, Anne has more than 25 years of experience as a teacher and director of early childhood programs. She's the author of teaching guides, classroom leaders, textbooks, picture books, and numerous publications for parents of young children. Anne is the early childhood coordinator for Northwestern University's Center for Talent Development and oversees the summer LeapFrog program. Anne is a frequent speaker at professional conferences such as the National Association for Young Children and the National Association for Gifted Children. She also teaches early childhood education courses at Oakton Community College and frequently provides training consultation for schools and organizations. Anne is joining us to talk with us about her latest book, Creating a Beautiful Mess, 10 Essential Play Experiences for a Joyous Childhood. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I have to say right out of the gate that right after I read the book, I thought, I want to go back in time and have a different childhood. I didn't have enough
play. You can still play.
And I love on the back cover your quote about play is a child's pathway to joy. I think that is such a powerful thing, that it is a joyful, that learning, we were actually talking backstage before the show, and I was saying how I really love doing shows because each week I have to learn about an author, and for me, that's a very joy-filled thing. I really enjoy learning about the people we're going to interview. And so I think that's maybe how I'm acting out my play now. Is that, it really is that play is really a pathway to joy, and learning is really, in my life, a joyful experience. And I have to ask right out of the gate, how did you get to writing this book? I mean, I know you've been doing this for a long time, but why did you feel that we needed to hear about play? Do you feel play had been kind of what I would call a lost art, or what was your thing that made you go, I want to write this book?
There's a very specific answer to that question. I had been doing a number of parent seminars as part of my work at Northwestern University, where I was meeting with parents and talking to them in small groups. And we were talking primarily about learning, but what parents were asking about had to do with play, and parents are concerned that their children are spending too much time with technology, that children, even at a very young age now, are spending a lot of time playing computer games, using tablets with touch screens that even, 2 and 3-year-olds are able to use, playing on their parents' smartphones. And I'm not anti-technology. I think there is a place for technology. But parents were asking me, what are our children missing out on when they're spending more and more time with technology? So I took a look at that question, and there are some good answers to that. There are certain kinds of play that children today are not engaging in as frequently as they did when I was a child or even 20 years ago. Some of that is kind of obvious. They're not playing outside quite as much as they used to. But there are things like playing with blocks or collecting things like stamps or coins that aren't happening as often. So I took a look at all the different kinds of play that make up a balanced childhood. So if you think of play the way you think of a child's nutrition or their diet, good parents offer their children a variety of foods, a balanced diet of foods. The same thing is true for play, that the children need all different kinds of play. They need a balance of active play, quiet play, pretend play, cuddle play, loud play. So I created 10 categories, and each chapter in my book, Creating a Beautiful Mess, describes one of those 10 categories, and it's my advice for a balanced and joyous childhood.
And it's after I read the book, I really had the feeling like we need a new food pyramid for kids, and in that pyramid needs to be play. I hadn't really thought of it until I read it. I hadn't really thought of play as nutrition. But it's really true. I mean, once that clicked in, I went, oh, my God, that's so true. Because as a child, when you're first finger painting, you have that first experience of, connecting your hand to the goo and making a shape or a form or, any of the tactile experiences, just that alone is huge amounts of nutrition for the nerves and for the brain and for play and joy. It was a mind-blowing aha for me.
Well, and it's also true that some children, just as some children like some foods more than others, children like certain kinds of play more than others. And so, this book is not about things, do's and don'ts. It's not a strict list, you have to do this for this many minutes a day. It's about offering joyous and fun experiences to your children to see what they enjoy most. Some children enjoy playing tea parties, and other children do not. So, offer a variety of play experiences, provide the time and the space explore a variety of play experiences and see what grows from that.
Well, can I ask a question that sort of pertains to this, but sort of very selfish on my part? When my kids were growing up in the 60s, we'd buy them these play school things and play school sets and all of that, and they'd play with the box. And my husband would say, you know, you're going to play with the toy. You know, and, but how much leeway should we give the kids to play with their own? If they want electronic, go for it.
Well, electronics are a special case because it is true. We have research now that shows us that when children are engaging with a screen, they're using a different part of their brain than when they're using their whole bodies. So, say, one of the really popular computer games right now is Minecraft. And there are a lot of benefits to playing that game. It can be very challenging, problem-solving, creative. But children also need to use their hands to construct things. They construct a virtual world in Minecraft. But they need to use their hands. They need to have those tactile and sensory experiences. So, you know, older children are playing with Minecraft, but even older children with the Legos and other kinds of complex construction toys can still be building three-dimensional structures. So the same thing is true with your example of the cardboard box, and that's probably true for younger children, for children who are preschool age, kindergarten age. They would rather play with the cardboard box than the toy that's inside of it. So I would give them all kinds of leeway when they want to use their whole bodies for play. And the book is called Creating a Beautiful Mess. It's named after one of the chapters, which is on sensory messy play. Creating a Beautiful Mess, Chapter 6, playing with finger paints, with Play-Doh, with clay, going outside and making mud pies and playing in the sand. So those really, like usually they involve water or some kind of sort of gooey texture. Those kinds of experiences are really, really important for young children. So using more than one of their senses is usually an indicator that that's a good kind of play. If they're touching things, if they're smelling it, if they're seeing it, if it makes noise or makes music, those are great experiences for kids. And sometimes just the cardboard box or just the plain wooden blocks will lead to those kinds of great play experiences.
How important is it the parents' involvement in playing with them, or should they leave them alone?
Well, when children are young, my experience and you know, I think the child development literature will back this up, is the children desire their parents' participation in play when they're young, when they're 2, 3, 4 years old, 5 years old. That's when they'll say to their parents, play with me, you know, they'll ask. And that's when parents feel torn. They have chores to do or they have work to do. They're trying to get the dinner on the table and their child says, play with me. I think what parents may not realize is that's not going to last that long. When they get to school, when they start first, second grade, naturally, as part of children's social development, their friends will become more important to them for most kids. And they won't be as interested in playing with their friends. So this happens in most children. This will happen quite naturally. We don't have to do anything to make that happen. That's part of human development. So I remind parents that, you know, this is kind of a golden time of play when they're 3 and 4 and 5 years old, when they really want their parents to play with them. They're inviting you to play with them. If you can carve out a little bit of time here and there, that's a great opportunity. These days will not last for long. So enjoy the play with your children.
Do you think we've lost some, or it's been kind of lost in schools, you know, the time for kids to play? I'm old enough that I grew up, you know, when there was actual recesses several times a day, and you'd go outside, and I happened to grow up in a, you know, well, not really a rural area, but kind of, well, actually pretty rural. And you'd go outside and there would be trees and forests. You'd have a playground, but, I mean, you were surrounded by nature out in the world playing, running around.
Yeah.
And it seems like some of that's been lost because our schools are either fearful about kids being outside, or, you know, they can't afford it, or it's not in the budget, or, you know, some, there's some reason why play seems to be, I can't think of the right metaphor, you know, like the last thing in line. That play isn't really thought of as powerful as a learning tool as it actually is. Have we lost some of that in schools, do you feel?
We have lost some of it, and there's plenty of data to show this, that children are not having as much opportunity for recess in an ordinary school day as they used to. But there is some recognition now, and I'm seeing the pendulum swing the other way. So I am hopeful that school policies are going to become more recognize this more frequently, and I'm seeing that in the Chicago area where I am, that many of the school districts are adding back some recess time. So I hope that that's going to continue. In terms of what's happening in the classroom, I talk a lot about block play. It's the first chapter in Creating a Beautiful Mess. And in my work with children, I do a lot of work with block play and construction play. When I started out working with young children 25, 30 years ago, when I was doing my student teaching, if you walked into a kindergarten classroom, there would be a block area in that classroom. It was standard practice to have a good set of solid wooden blocks, and it was part of everyday play for children. And you don't see that anymore. It's very rare that you would see blocks in a kindergarten classroom. And what's so great about blocks is that it's an open-ended toy that grows with the child, and there's so much math and geometry in block play. So the children are being exposed to the different shapes. They're not just learning the names of the shapes like they would if you were doing, say, a worksheet on shapes. What is the triangle? What is the square? That's a very limited learning experience for children on paper. If they're engaging with these shapes in a three-dimensional way, they're learning very sophisticated concepts about math and about physics. They are learning about balance and symmetry when they construct a tower. They're learning that if you put two triangles together, you can make a square. So they're understanding with their hands some very complex math and physics concepts that they're going to encounter later in their school. So they can play with blocks at home as well. This is something I encourage parents to find time for their children to do. But again, it's these kinds of sensory experiences and full body experiences that really benefit children. It benefits them in terms of being happy and having fun, but it also sets the stage for some exciting learning experiences later on in their school career.
I'm laughing because it makes me realize that I think I didn't have enough block time as a child because my math skills are terrible. And I was never good at it. You know, I'm very visual. I'm very good at figuring things out visually. But in terms of math, I just didn't have enough block time. That's what I'm going to blame it on now. I'm going to use that now. I didn't have enough block time as a kid.
That might be true. You know, I enjoyed playing with blocks when I was a kid, but the blocks belong to my brothers. I have two older brothers, and I received a message from the world that blocks were for boys. And I think even today, girls are not as encouraged to play with blocks as boys are. And I'm very interested in my work at Northwestern with encouraging girls and young women to pursue STEM topics, science, technology, engineering, and math. And I think early block play, construction play with Legos or with cardboard, you know, cardboard boxes and stacking them up and making a fort, I think we really need to make sure that girls have as many opportunities for this kind of play as boys do.
You know,
cool thing. Go ahead, Sherry.
I can just see a worksheet for parents. This is what you're going to play with your kids tonight. Not that you're doing homework, which is what my concept of helping kids through school, but this is what you're going to play with this evening.
Yeah, I would love to see that kind of homework. I think that a lot of homework that teachers assign is busy work that's not that helpful to children. I've been doing a number of these radio interviews since the book was released in August, and sometimes people ask me about homework, which is not a topic that's addressed in the book, but I actually encourage parents to take a play break with their children when they're doing homework. Like, set the timer. If you have some homework that your child doesn't really want to do, say, well, let's do it for 15 minutes, and then we'll take a little play break, and we'll either build the blocks, or we'll go outside and run around for a few minutes, or maybe we'll play with the Play-Doh or the clay for a few minutes, and then come back to the homework after that. And I bet your child is going to have a fresher outlook and maybe even have some sparks to their brain that they didn't have before. So I think that would be a great idea if teachers would encourage parents to play with their kids as part of the homework or as a balance to doing homework.
Do you think that why do you think play, was there some point in the educational system where, sort of during that technological era, I guess, you know, the evolution of tech, that play got slightly set aside or ignored? Or, like I say, it's just the kid at the back of the bus waiting to come forward? It just seems like it's an underrated skill, and it's such a powerful learning tool.
Well, you know, I've been in the field of education for about 30 years now. And when I started out, you know, I mentioned the block corner. We used to talk about the whole child, that a child is not just their cognitive or academic ability. It's also their physical, their social. We were concerned with, you know, just being a good person in the world. And what happened in the last 10, 15 years is there has been more of a focus on accountability, which has led to standardized testing, some of the other public policy changes that we've seen that have had a negative impact on the kinds of experiences that we're talking about. I am hopeful that that's going to change, though. And as I said, I think, you know, the pendulum is swinging the other way, and we see this over time. This happens in all kinds of topics in education. Right now in education, we're seeing an emphasis on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and we're seeing how having time to do science experiments where you're working with real materials, where you're observing animals or pets, what we call project-based learning or problem-based learning, where the children are presented with an idea or a problem and they have to figure out how to solve it by working together. There are definitely some new progressive movements in education that are turning things back towards really engaging learning experiences. So I'm very hopeful that we're going in the right direction in the field of education. And I could talk about that more, but the book, Creating a Beautiful Mess, is really focused on parents and the joy at home. And the advice I give to parents is to actually not worry so much about what they're learning from play. Worry about whether your child is relaxed and enjoying the play and whether you're enjoying the play with them. You know, I don't want parents to feel like playing with your child is just another thing on the to-do list and you have to make yourself do it. I think it's a good idea to think about your own childhood and what you really enjoyed playing when you were a kid, and maybe try to relive some of those experiences through your own child. Find the things that you really enjoy, and then when you do those things together, it will be such a great experience for you, for your whole family.
My family is very interested in puzzles, and the kids from an early age saw us do puzzles, and that engaged them in U.S. puzzles and other kinds of things that we could play with them. That's just a comment. But we have a question from the audience. What is the difference between autism play and, I don't want to say regular play, their question really, after a very long piece here, is there different play strategies for autistic kids or ADHD kids than other children?
That is a really interesting question, and I do not have a specialized credential in play with children on the autism spectrum or children with special needs. So I can't speak to that from a expertise in that area. But I will say that in the work that I've done at Northwestern University with the Center for Talent Development, where we serve children who are academically gifted or cognitively advanced, that we do have quite a few children in our program who are on the autism spectrum, who have excelled or have indicate a potential for advanced academic ability, but at the same time have delays in language or social ability, or may have delays in small motor skills, the ability to write or to manipulate small objects. And so it's not unusual for a child to have varying arenas of development where one is ahead and one is behind. And for parents who are seeking, you know, these joyous play experiences with their children, I would go back to this idea of balance, which is true for all children, that you offer children a wide variety of play experiences, and some of them will be more interesting to them than others. And so say a child who is on the autism spectrum, and maybe they have one area of really special interest. I have a nephew who's on the autism spectrum, and he's really interested in trains. And so he loves to play with trains. He loves to look at pictures of trains. He loves to ride on trains. And there is nothing wrong with supporting that child's special interest. You're certainly going to offer that child other experiences, and perhaps on another day something else might be of interest to them. But if that is where the child's passion and interest is, I would encourage the parent to pursue that and to be with the child, to be present with the child while they're having those wonderful play experiences. So to sit side by side with them while they're playing with the train set, to observe them, to ask them questions. And if the child is not interested in engaging in a conversation, that's fine. You know, as a parent, I think our job often is just to accompany our child on this journey of where they're going and being with them when they're enjoying their play, when play is going really well, even if they're not cooperating or collaborating in the play, if it's something that they're doing individually, I think there's still a lot of value to that. So that's what I would have to offer in terms of my, you know, limited experience with that topic. You know, like I said, I'm not an expert, but from what I've seen, I think that parents and children benefit from allowing a child to pursue their interest in whatever direction that would take them.
There, this is a little question, but it leads to something very big. What do you do with children who color outside the lines?
Well, that question assumes that you're giving them lines, you know. the play that I describe in Creating a Beautiful Mess, for the most part, is really open-ended play where there aren't any lines. You know, so when we talk about finger paint and we talk about, you know, these really messy sensory experiences, there's no expectation that they're going to stay within the lines. One of the true stories of my own childhood that I wrote about in the book is every once in a while, it's only happened a couple of times, my mom would let us take our ice cream pops, our fudge pops on a stick, and she would let us draw on the table with our ice cream. And she made sure that the table, you know, was clean first because she knew that it would go on the table, in our mouth, on the table, in our mouth. And then afterwards, she would, you know, sort of hose us off and we'd get all clean and she'd clean off the table. So that's a great example of there not being any lines. So I don't know if that actually answers your question or not. If a child really enjoys coloring in a coloring book, then go for it. But for the most part, I would give children lots of open-ended experiences that can go in any direction and don't have to be done a certain way.
I think the audience member was really saying, should we insist that they stay in the lines or should we just go with where they want to color? So that open-ended kind of thing is
yeah.
a good answer. But do you just show...
Well,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
I guess I would just say I took a lot of words to answer the question. I don't think they have to stay within the line. Not at home. I mean, if it's a homework assignment that's been given by a teacher and they're supposed to color something a certain way, then yes, we can encourage them to meet the expectations of the teacher. But when children are engaged in play, play by definition is not... doesn't have a specific goal, doesn't have to lead to one thing. So, you know, if a child wants to color outside of the lines, then find an opportunity to let them do that when it's not a homework assignment.
I remember when my eldest daughter was 6 years old, many years ago, she's in her 50s now, But she got punished at school because they were doing Thanksgiving turkeys, and she put little trickles behind the turkey of turkey poop, and because that's what was happening in our yard. You know, the turkeys were running around pooping every place, and she was warned not to step on. But she got punished in school for that without them ever getting in touch with us at all. So there needs to be some understanding between the school and the parents, and I think that was missing in our school. How do you encourage that?
Well, I had a similar experience when I was a child. I remember in second grade we had to make a picture of a barn with snow on the roof for a Christmas card for our families, and the teacher was so specific about it having to be done a certain way, and I think I put the snow in the wrong place and got in trouble. So unfortunately, there are teachers like that. I hope that there are fewer now than there used to be. But again, when the children are at home with their parents, we want to give them all kinds of freedom. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, the turkey with the, you know, little droppings. That is such a normal interpretation of the world from a young child. I mean, children are interested in bodily functions of animals and people. And one of the fun chapters of the book in terms of me when I was working on Creating a Beautiful Mess is there is a chapter that's called Laughing, Joking, and Other General Silliness. And I think sometimes parents are concerned that, you know, their child is overly concerned with, like, bathroom jokes and bathroom humor. And I really reassure parents that that's a normal part of childhood. You can certainly set limits on that. You don't want them to do that in church or, you know, when you have a special family guest over. But being goofy and being funny is such a great way to play with your kids. And it often happens so spontaneously that we want to give children the freedom to express themselves, I believe.
Well, in your book, you talk about how developing a sense of humor is a really important social skill. That's another part of the aspect of play, why I'm putting nutrition in the children's nutrition, you know, triangle, food triangle, is play, is because a sense of humor is such a powerful thing to have and develop, you know, and have it as a social skill.
It's one of the primary ways that children make friends with each other. You know, when my daughter was little and I'd take her to the park and she'd want to play with the other kids, maybe kids that she hadn't met before that she didn't know. You know, I think as parents, we will say, we'll encourage our child to be very formal about it, to walk up to the other child and say, "May I play with you?" And, you know, we'll teach them these rituals of how you should introduce yourself to someone. But actually what really happens is the children will go up to each other and they might make a funny noise or do something goofy or make a funny face and make the other kid laugh. And that's a wonderful way to start a friendship. So the children who are really good at connecting to other kids and making friends quickly often are the really silly, goofy ones. So I think sometimes parents don't realize that's a great social skill. That's a great opener in a way that a formal invitation to play might not work.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about, this seems like, that just saying this, how it seems tricky because I can hear all the parents that I know out there going, "No, not that." You talk about something called risky play and that it's important. Mm-hmm. What is risky play?
Yeah.
It sounds, I know if I said that to my, you know, son's, you know, wife, they'd go, "Risky play? What?" You know, they'd be freaked out.
Well,
so what is risky play?
You know, I use the term risky and when I'm writing about outdoor active play. And what I'm really talking about is the freedom to run fast, to climb high, to throw a rock in a muddy puddle. So I'm not talking about, you know, riding their bike off the roof of the porch, right? You know, I'm not talking about doing really reckless things. But what I've noticed and what I saw in my research about play is that playgrounds today are not as challenging to children physically as they used to be. They are safer, and I think that's wonderful. I don't argue with that at all. What's safer about playgrounds now, which is really good, is that the playground surfaces are so much safer. So we pay much more attention now to the wood chips and the rubber materials that are at the bottom of the playground. But unfortunately, because of liability and regulations, playground equipment is not as tall as it used to be. So it used to be you could have a slide that was, and when I was a kid, it looked like it was 3 stories tall. You know, you'd have these really tall slides. You'd have these really tall jungle gyms. And you don't see those as much anymore. So children are not being challenged in physically with their strength and their dexterity and their balance and the kinds of physical skills that the children really need practice with in order to get really good at it. So the way children learn how to be safe when they climb is by practicing it and having, appropriate experiences falling down. So that means with little toddlers, the first time they learn to walk, they fall down. Or the first time they go up one or two little stairs, they might fall down. So these very small experiences, climbing and falling and testing themselves, that's how they learn to be safe. That's how they learn the limits of their bodies. And when I was a preschool teacher, we had these old-fashioned swings. You don't see these anymore. This was 20 years ago, where the seat of the swing could be adjusted to different heights. So there was the low level, and then you could notch it up higher and higher. And our rule was for the children, you could put it as high as you want, as long as you can climb yourself into that swing without an adult lifting you up. And that was such a great fail-safe because the children would only be able to get it as high as they could physically safely get themselves in and out of that swing. So it was a great way to teach the children of their own limits. So when I talk about risky play, I'm talking about giving children appropriate opportunities to challenge themselves physically. So if the playground doesn't offer that as they get older, maybe there's a tree in the backyard that they could climb. Maybe there's a park that's made for older kids that you could visit once in a while. So give children the opportunities to test themselves physically, to challenge themselves physically.
We have some interesting questions coming in from the audience. One, should kids be forced to play?
No. No, because as I said, play by definition is spontaneously lack of goal directed. So if you tell them to play, then you're taking the joy out of it. So I would say no. And, you know, what children choose to do, whether it's reading a book or writing a story or doing something that looks like work to us, if they are choosing it, if it's their choice and it's coming from their own desire, then that's where their joy will come from. So when children are at home, if there's not homework to be done, you know, if that's an opportunity for them to pursue their own joy, then allow them to make those choices.
There are so many good questions here, and one is a comment to what you just said, that often if an adult will begin the play, that the kid's reluctant to come into, maybe because they don't know how to do it. So if the adult plays first, the kids will come along. Here's a great, great question. Is getting dirty okay?
Well, I would say yes, within reason. And I think every family is going to have a different set of limits for that. You know, I mentioned my mom letting us paint on the table with ice cream. I think we only did that twice in my whole childhood. You know, so it was not a daily thing. It was, and that's why I remember it so clearly, because it was so special and so exciting to us. So I'm sure it was a day when she didn't have a lot else going on. It was probably a day where the weather was warm enough where she could take us out and rinse off our hands and our arms with the hose. So every parent needs to make your own decisions about what's right for you. I know a parent who will not allow Play-Doh in her house, and it's just because she has these nice white wall-to-wall carpeting. She does not want to get any ground Play-Doh in there. So they could go outdoors and do Play-Doh. They could sit out on the patio and do Play-Doh out there, or they could just do it at somebody else's house. So it's really up to each parent, I think. But if you find some way, like in the bathtub, you know, just making bubbles in the bathtub, splashing around, that can bring you the same pleasure that painting on the table with ice cream can bring. So find a way to have these kinds of experiences in a way that makes sense for you and your family.
One of my kids used to love to scribble on any wall she could find.
And oh, no.
And Avon made these little things that you could put on the walls in the bathroom, and it would wash right mm-hmm. off. I love that stuff. But
yeah,
we finally put up boards, like whiteboards, on the wall so the kids could scribble mm-hmm. all over. So working with them instead of against them worked for us. I have two other questions. One is, when we were younger, we were taught distraction as a way of moving our child from one activity to the other, that maybe one was dangerous. Is there something modern now that you would suggest to, I guess, really distract the kid if you don't want them playing electronic games?
Mm-hmm.
And this one said she had an 11-year-old boy, and it was like pulling teeth to try to get him away from his electronic games. Is there some trick?
Well, I don't think there's a trick, and I think that the lure of the computer games and the technology is that it is so visually enticing to children that it's easy to get distracted. So I've been talking to parents lately about how they make decisions about limits on computer games, because, you know, some computer games are good. Some of them are great, so but how much time? And what I've been hearing that sounds really good to me is parents who will say, I will let my child, you know, use the iPad, or I'll let my child, you know, play Minecraft after certain other requirements are met, after the homework is done, and maybe add something else in. After the child has read a good book for 15 minutes, or after the child has done something creative with blocks or Legos for 15 minutes. And if you set a very short limit on it with one of these engaging alternatives, often what happens is the child will do that longer than 15 minutes. They'll get into the book and they'll read for 20 minutes, or they'll start building something with Legos and they'll play for half an hour, and then they'll remember, oh yeah, I was going to play Minecraft, or oh yeah, I was going to get the iPad, and then they'll go to it. But they will have done something else constructive and creative first before they turn to the technology. But parents do have to think about that and figure out a limit or a household rule that's going to make sense for them.
Okay, I have one modern question and one old question here. In certain cities in North Carolina, in this audience, each child is given an iPad as part of the school curriculum, and lessons and homework are on the iPad. What's your thought?
Yeah, I think a lot of schools are going to go that way because the technology is such an integral part of the curriculum now, and that's not a bad thing. But when the child is taking that iPad home, how do you know if they're using it to do their homework or if they're playing a game, or how do you know if they're downloading something that they shouldn't be downloading? So one of the resources that I recommend to parents, and it's mentioned in Creating a Beautiful Mess, is the website called Common Sense Media, commonsensemedia.org. It is a nonprofit organization that provides reviews of apps and games and movies and videos for parents, and they're very brief. So if your child wants to do something on the iPad that's not part of the school curriculum, you can look it up on Common Sense Media, find out what that game is rated, what age it's appropriate for, or a website. Having a resource like that where you can make good decisions about what your child is using the technology for, because most of us most parents, I think probably all parents, unless you're a really young parent, did not grow up with any of this technology ourselves. So we are digital tourists, and our children are digital natives because they're growing up with this being, you know, all around them like a... So we often feel intimidated or concerned that we're not going to know enough about it to be able to help our child make good decisions. So if we can find just a few good resources like Common Sense Media, if we sit down with our children and play the game with them and see what they're seeing, I think that it will set us more at ease in terms of feeling confident that we can make good decisions about our children's use of technology.
This is an old-fashioned question, but I can see how it would go into modern. How could we make making cookies, is that a play or a learning, and how would you approach it for kindergarten or high school?
Oh, I think making cookies is a joyous activity when the parent and the child are both wanting to do it. It reminds me a little bit of creating a beautiful mess because it's multisensory. You know, so you're mixing stuff up and maybe even touching it with your fingers, and you're smelling it and you're tasting it and you're hearing the sounds of the ingredients, you know, mushing up together, and you're doing it with someone you love. So it's not necessarily a play experience because it's goal-directed. You want to end up with those cookies in the end. But it can be very playful. And, you know, like I said, it's multisensory. When my daughter was little, she really wanted to touch all the ingredients before they went into the bowl. And, of course, I didn't let her do that with all of them. But I give her a little bit of flour in a little cup or a little plastic bowl that she could just pat it because she thought it was so soft she wanted to touch it. So those kinds of experiences are so important to children. So even if it's not play by the strictest definition, it definitely is something that will benefit children.
I can see where with the kindergarten kids, you could, let's make a circle cookie, let's make a triangle cookie. But with eighth or ninth graders, probably, how do we double or half this recipe?
So I can exactly. See, yeah.
I can see a book in your future. How to take an example of one activity, and here's the grade levels for it. I think that would be awesome.
Yeah. Okay, I'll start working on that one.
I also put in both chats, there's another great resource for information. There's a journalist, a tech journalist, Larry Magid, who has had a site called safekids.com for a long time. And he talks about being a tech person by foundation, a tech writer, and a passion for children having a safe experience in the tech world. He writes a lot of articles about, you know, education and good apps and ways to do things. And, you know, he also has another aside website from safekids.com called connectsafely.org. And he's a great resource for all sorts of, you know, tech information. One of the things I would say about the iPad world, although I'm more of an Android pad person myself, is I think one of the benefits of using that kind of technology is it makes the teacher's job theoretically easier in that they can distribute, a homework or a thing without all this paperwork. They can create it, they can publish it to the page that's appropriate for the children. They get it, they do it, they send it back. And so it eliminates a lot of the shuffling of papers and the moving around of papers. So I think ultimately, once we adapt to it, I think it's a positive thing. And yet I still feel hesitation from the, I don't know when it's, you've talked about it, I'm just talking about myself in the sense of, it's a tricky thing because I see a lot of kids on iPads or iPods or i-something kind of devices. I was having dinner with friends last night and somebody sat down with their child, four-ish, three-ish, I don't know, and their distraction for him was to hand him the iPhone. And rather than have him engage or try and get him to engage in the conversation at the table or be involved with the food, that was his... you know, their go-to of like, oh, here, this makes him be quiet. And I think that's a tricky thing. I just think that's tricky. I'm not saying anything bad about phones. I'm just saying I think that's a tricky thing when you, it's like there was a period in the, let's say 50s, when TV was becoming, you know, a thing where you would just plop the kid down in front of the TV and that was their entertainment. And that's tricky when you start using a device of whatever the device is as like, oh, this keeps the kid quiet. Am I having a weird judgment about that, or is that a trick? Is that a tricky area?
As a parent, I would say, realistically, we all do that in one way or another, even if it's not a phone. I mean, there are things that need to get done. We have to get the dishes washed up. We have to get the laundry done. So I'm very sympathetic to parents. Based on my own experience, you know, I really want to encourage parents to trust themselves as they make these decisions and not be too discouraged by some of the things that they might hear or read in the media. Like listen to yourself of what makes sense to you. So that said, then I would also say that children do need some limits on the technology. And I guess, you know, one idea that I think is really helpful to me is thinking in terms of, are you using the technology as a playpen or are you using it as a playground? And I'm not the first one to use this term. I see this a lot in the tech literature now. So is it something, is the app itself or the game itself or the website itself, is it something that's just keeping your child busy, that's not benefiting them in any way, it's just killing time, like a playpen? Or is it a playground? Is it offering your child some kind of expansive or creative experience? So is it a game where the child is just, you know, shooting bottles off a fence virtually? Or is it a storybook where the children are creating their own characters and choosing the dialogue and the setting for the story? So there's an app, for example, called Scratch Junior, which is an animation app where children create their own characters and create their own stories. Even 3 and 4-year-olds, you don't have to be able to read to use this app. So that's an example of an app that's a playground, that's expanding the child's experience. So, you know, use technology wisely and, you know, be gentle and generous with yourself as you're trying to figure these things out, because we're all struggling with this. All parents are struggling with this.
And I would even make a bigger picture in that and say, for adults, that's all true. Everything you just said about technology is completely true for adults. I see grown-ups eating together and they're too busy, you know, texting or Facebooking or something to actually put the blank thing down and engage with each other. So I think it's a great learning tool for everybody. But learn to use it correctly.
And we are the
role
models, aren't we?
I'm shocked to find that we're at the end of our time. Where would you like people to find more out about you? Do you do workshops or classes or lectures? Would you like people to follow you? Oh, great.
Yeah, I have an author website, which is my name, anngadzikowski.com, and that's anngadzikowski.com. And I know that's hard to remember, so I just tell people Creating a Beautiful Mess is the name of the book. And if you just Google Creating a Beautiful Mess, you'll find me. The book is online and all the usual places and in bookstores. So I hope you'll find me on the Internet.
Do you have a Facebook page by chance? Do people follow you?
Do
you like being followed on Facebook?
Right. I have an author Facebook page. And if you like me on Facebook, then, you know, regular announcements about where I'm speaking or articles that I've published will also appear on that Facebook page.
Wonderful. Okay, I have to hang up now because I have to go buy blocks. I need some block time.
Okay.
I can feel it coming
good.
On. That was really great, Anne. Thank you so much.
Maybe Lego.
There's actually, I have to say it, there's an amazing article you have on your site in your blog section on Legos. I posted it to both chats because I had read it before the show and I thought, oh my God, I didn't know this about Legos to begin with. It's an amazing historical story talking about Legos. And, you know, yeah, it makes me think, well, maybe skip blocks, go right to Legos. I need to be, like, have a table where I can be building something in Legos. That would be awesome.
Yeah, do both.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right,
everybody.
Well,
have a great Thank you. That was fun. And thanks, Sherry. Any closing thoughts, Sherry?
There is a great many links in the chat for people over here at WebEx. So go into the chat, click Control A, and grab all of those. And want to remind people that we are doing a series of free classes in the month of October. This one is maintenance and repair. So if you would like to be part of that, please get in touch. Or just visit our website, soundhealthoptions.com. And remember the drawing.
Oh, that's right. For people on Blog Talk Radio, email Sherry at sherryedwards@gmail.com to get into that drawing. All right, everybody, have a great rest of the weekend, and we'll see you soon, Tuesday. Next Sunday, somebody's talking. We're talking with somebody next Sunday. I can't tell you who right now. All right, thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.